Under President Trump's proposed budget, a national lab in Peoria focused on agricultural research would be shut down. Illinois' congressional delegation is urging President Trump to reconsider.
The work that goes on at the Ag Lab in Peoria is not just for Illinois, it's really for the entire country.
That's Republican Representative Darren LaHood. Democratic Congressman Sherry Bustos both talk about the bipartisan congressional effort to try to save the lab. Plus, if Illinois' budget impasse doesn't get resolved by the end of this week, 700 state-funded road construction projects may be halted indefinitely. How might that affect your travel plans? But first, the Supreme Court is allowing parts of President Trump's travel ban against citizens of six majority Muslim countries to go into effect. What does this mean for Illinois? We want to hear your thoughts. Give us a call now. 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. Our handle's 21ST Show. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case of President Trump's travel ban and said parts of it can be reinstated until it hears the case in October. In particular, the court said the ban on visitors from six majority Muslim countries could be enforced in most cases. Visitors from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen can be banned as long as those visitors don't have a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity from the U.S. Don't worry, we're going to be explaining more about what that means in a minute. Today, we also wanted to look at what this means for Illinois with a legal expert, someone from the Syrian refugee community, and we'll hear from the president of our largest public university system, Timothy Killeen of the University of Illinois, about what he thinks about the ban. We've also been asking you on social media what you think. We've got your questions we're going to get to, some comments as well, especially from Reddit. You can join the conversation as well now. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet your comments. Our handle is 21STShow. Let's start with Eugene Kontarovich. He's an expert on constitutional law in the federal courts, and he's a law professor with Northwestern University's Pritzker School. Eugene, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
Is it clear what this bona fide relationship means yet? Can you explain a little bit more about that for us?
Yeah, what the court is saying is that the president cannot have his general authority over immigration matters suspended on the mere making of a general constitutional argument that is very broad, and that the president can basically continue to conduct immigration policy. Now, as we know, there was a difference between the first and second executive order. The second executive order made clear that people existing green card holders would not be affected. So what this is saying is that people who are already in the system in some way, even if they don't have a green card, but if they've applied for a visa or have a family relationship with someone or have been invited to study at some university, perhaps, and thus have a pre-existing relationship, for them, this order will not take effect. But otherwise, the president can continue to exclude, general foreigners from these countries, while the case is adjudicated.
I imagine, though, when we say that, when we look at the language of a credible claim of a relationship with a person or entity from the U.S., wouldn't that be most people who are coming into the U.S.?
Not at all, not necessarily. So much of this is just about people applying for example, refugee visas or other kinds of visas who have not yet applied. And, you know, their only relationship is they happen to want to come to the United States, but that is not a pre-existing relationship. They're not, for example, you know, a pre-existing relationship is if one is a, let's say, a close relation of someone who can sponsor a visa, or if one is a, you know, has a recurring business relationship that brings one to America. But, you know, if one is simply seeking a visa because one wants to move to America, or that is not a pre-existing relationship. That's not a close relationship.
And so in the case of universities, it sounds like what you're saying, faculty would be exempt from this. What about students? Would faculty and students be sort of on a similar standing probably then?
Yeah, existing faculty and students. But for example, if one simply is from these countries and, you know, would generally like to go to school in the United States, that's not a pre-existing relationship. And basically, let me just say that the general idea here, the scope of the original injunctions was exceedingly broad, because the normal rule of courts deciding cases is they decide specific controversies between, you know, specific parties that are limited to specific facts. So courts don't, you know, just strike down entire measures. They say that measures cannot be applied based on a certain set of facts. And what this does is it limits the power of courts, because courts have to go one case at a time. Unlike a legislature or a president using delegated powers, the courts cannot act with, you know, a broad universal brush. Right, that's one of the things that makes courts different from legislatures. They're limited by the facts of the cases. And what these first injunctions had said is, it doesn't matter what the facts are. We are basically suspending this law as applied to all and any possible facts. And that's extremely rare and extremely unusual, especially for a law which everyone agreed is not facially problematic, but is only problematic if one makes certain assumptions about the motivations of the drafters. So both given those, you know, that unusual merits setup, the scope of the original orders was extremely broad. So the court taking this position rather narrows this in a way which is not surprising and would have been wise if it had been done originally.
Eugene, we got an email from Alan in Champaign who said he was confused because President Trump initially announced this on January 27th and said they needed the 90-day pause to review and revise its vetting procedures. And Alan pointed out that was 150 days ago, and the Trump administration is still fighting for 90 days to review. He says none of this makes sense. I wanted to ask you about the timing of all of that.
Well, that's correct. Well, I think for much of the past 150 days, the administration has not been able to do the detailed vetting of the immigration and visa policies of these countries because it has been busy fighting, defending the order, and trying to deal with the review of the people coming in. That is to say, the administration's position is we need to stop the people coming in so we can review the systems and processes for vetting these people and where they come from. Now, given that there has not been that suspension, they have not had the time to do the thing which they said they needed the suspension to have time to do. That's one point. Also, not all of the measures in the executive order did have this 90-day limit. There was a general reduction and restriction on the amount on the number of on refugees, for example. But also, the order did not say that this would only take 90 days. It said we're doing this for 90 days, and then of course it could be renewed. So this could also be seen as an implicit renewal, though they don't have to formally renew it because it was suspended. That happens all the time with executive measures. They say we're going to do something for 90 days, and then another 90 days, and another 90 days, because obviously with government work, not everything gets done by the original stated deadline. But they didn't set a deadline for themselves. They didn't say, you know, this can only take 90 days. They said, we'll take 90 days and see where we get.
And they haven't
had those 90 days.
Right. That makes sense. That makes sense, everybody. Yeah. We're asking all of you, by the way, on social media, what you think about the travel ban. You can weigh in now. You can tweet to 21st Show. In the case of the University of Illinois, one student weighed in on Reddit. The student said, quote, I think Trump's ban, his rants against several foreign countries, and the recent still unsolved kidnapping might make the university seem like both a hostile and unsafe place for international students. They might think the, quote, extreme vetting and outright bans for some countries to go to a place that seems unsafe might not be worth their time and effort. There are good universities and other developed countries that offer a comparable quality of education. Those options might begin to seem more attractive to foreign students. That's one comment that we got on Reddit earlier. By the way, that kidnapping that student is referring to is in regards to the University of Illinois and a missing Chinese scholar, Jingyang Zhang, who disappeared on June 9th. In Urbana, in a case that the FBI says is a national priority. She hasn't been seen since then. We're going to tweet out more information about her case, including the number to call if you have any information. Earlier this morning, Timothy Killeen, who's president of the University of Illinois, spoke with WILL about how the travel ban could affect the university. The University of Illinois, a reminder, has one of the highest ratios of international students of public research universities. Here's what he had to say.
We're very concerned about travel bans like this. And we did an assessment of the vulnerability of U of I to the executive order as it was first announced. And in Urbana-Champaign, we're talking about almost 140 students, 10 faculty and staff that might be directly affected. In Chicago, it's over 160 students and almost 20 faculty and staff that would be directly affected because they come from those countries. And these are top scholars and top faculty. So we have a direct exposure to the executive order, but we'll look hard at what the Supreme Court decision really means for the next few months.
President Clean also had this to say when asked about the effect of the travel ban on recruitment and enrollment of international students on U of I's campuses.
I would say we're doing well on our enrollment, on our overall enrollment. We're paying very close attention to it, and obviously we have a new class coming in the fall. It's likely to be another bumper crop, particularly in Chicago, I would say. We've seen strong interest on the part of international students. We've not seen a significant weakening there. I'm more concerned about Illinois families and students, given the domestic situation. So we've not seen that yet, but we're paying close attention to both the applications and the enrollments, and of course the acceptances of the offers, which is what we're going through right now.
That's University of Illinois President Timothy Clean. Paul on Twitter is asking, what are the implications for the state on refugees? Is this a prior status? We've been actually, speaking of refugees, we know that the State Department has said the ban will be implemented starting 72 hours after being cleared by the courts, which means this would take effect on Thursday morning. We've checked in numerous times with the Syrian Community Network here in Illinois. Maya Atassi is the interim deputy director for the Syrian Community Network and joins us now. Maya, thanks for being with us on the 21st.
Maya, thank you for having me.
Were you worried, Maya, that this Supreme Court ruling would come down and part of the ban would be reinstituted?
You know, I think we were kind of heartened by the fact that the Fourth and Ninth Circuit Court decisions had kind of put a pause on the ban, but it was always in the back of our mind that we knew that we had to be prepared for this day to come. We knew that the administration was adamant that this was going to go through and they were going to continue pushing. But I think it was the timing that we were more surprised by, just because we assumed that because it was put on the docket for the fall slate, we were kind of surprised that the court made this decision kind of before the case was actually heard.
Were you all working with any refugees who were coming in this week? I wonder what the immediate effect has been on the Syrian Community Network.
You know, we haven't had, we've heard that from other organizations, because we actually work with the refugees once they arrive in Chicago. So we work in partnership with the resettlement organizations that sponsor them through the State Department. And we had heard that starting in June and July, that the numbers were expected to pick up. I know that in March and April, the numbers have really kind of slowed down in terms of refugees being entered into Illinois, resettled in Illinois. So numbers for June and July had been expected to rise, but I'm not sure now how that will be affected once this ban is put into place starting on Thursday. The strange thing is this, with the bona fide relationship and being not just a family tie, but also to an organization, to us, that raises a lot of questions, such as, you know, is the resettlement organization, can that qualify if there is a pre-existing relationship, if they've already, their application has already been accepted and their sponsorship by the resettlement here in the U.S. has already been picked up, does that qualify? Are those refugees, are those families going to be allowed to enter, or is the ban going to kind of put a halt on their re-entry into the U.S.? It really kind of remains to be seen. I think the terms being broad, it kind of depends on where they're coming from, how each, organization and each, the security, how they will interpret the ban and how people will act like staff in the airport and such as that.
What are you hearing from the rest of the community here, Maya, in terms of refugees who have already come? I imagine they're following this very closely.
Yeah, for the families that are already here, you kind of have twofold concerns. They have worries that suddenly once a ban like this is put into place, will it then the next shift or the next phase of such a ban turn to people who are already here? Will they start to be? You have the worries about them being rounded up and taken away. And we try to, we've hosted a couple of seminars and things like that to let them know that they have rights and that they, you know, they have a recourse for if that were to happen. But we try to remain confident. We work closely with the local precinct, Chicago Police Department, and they let us know that they have nothing to fear from us. It's not our job to round up, you know, immigrants and refugees, and we're just trying to keep the public safe. It's not our job to kind of check their papers or try to act anything in terms of immigration. So they have that concern, and then some other families have family ties that they were hoping to be reunited with, families that were still back in Jordan or Turkey or one of the neighboring countries, Syria, whose applications were still pending. So again, that remains to be seen, depending on what stage of their application was in, whether or not that those families will still be reunited.
Maya, you know, we just have about a minute left, but I wonder what you would say to people listening who say they think this ban, particularly for refugees from Syria, is necessary for maintaining safety in the United States.
I would say that the refugee resettlement process, especially in the U.S., you know, there's extreme vetting. You know, people say we need to add extreme vetting. Well, extreme vetting is already in place. These families, their application process takes 1.5 to 2 years between the time that they've decided that they accept the idea of applying to another country for resettlement and then to actually get the final decision. So the extreme vetting and process is already in place, multiple background checks, multiple security screenings. So it's, you know, the process is in place, and that's meant to secure the safety of our borders. And then also just that, you know, to think back to the promise of America, why this country was founded. We were founded as a democratic, you know, haven for those that were seeking opportunity and new life. And these families are fleeing, you know, a situation that they are can no longer bear to live in. They need the safety of their security of their children. For many of these families, they would
tell
you.
So it sounds like, I'm afraid. Thank you for that, Maya. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I want to thank Maya Atassi, Eugene Kontorovich, for joining me. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks, Maya. Thanks, Eugene.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering knowledge in its disciplines by recruiting and retaining library faculty, researchers, and thought leaders with deep subject matter knowledge and expert librarianship. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. A bipartisan group of Illinois lawmakers is urging President Trump to reconsider his plans to close a national research lab in Peoria. 15 members of Illinois' congressional delegation, including both Senators Durbin and Duckworth, and 13 members of the House signed the letter. It included many representatives around the lab, except for Republicans Rodney Davis and John Shimkus, who did not sign the letter. We've just tweeted it out, by the way, if you want to see that, follow us at 21ST Show. The National Center for Agricultural Utilization Research opened in 1940. There are 17 labs like this around the country, all of them slated for closure under President Trump's proposed budget. The Peoria Lab, though, is the largest of its kind in the U.S., with roughly 200 people working there. It's the place where the method to mass produce penicillin was discovered, where xanthan was created, among other things. Republican Representative Darren LaHood is one of the congressional leaders who signed the letter urging President Trump to reconsider. He represents Illinois' 18th congressional district, and we spoke with him yesterday. Congressman LaHood, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you for having me on.
Congressman, obviously the loss of 200 jobs would be a blow to Peoria, especially when you think about 80 PhD scientists being laid off. Is this just about those jobs? What more do you think will be lost?
Well, people have to realize the Peoria Agriculture Lab is one of four regional labs across the country. And the work that goes on at the Ag Lab in Peoria is not just for Illinois, it's really for the entire country. And when you see the scientists there, the PhDs and the researchers that every single day work on food safety, work on agriculture products, work with many private sector industries on cutting edge technology and food byproducts, it is, we can't let this go. And that's why we've really stepped up an effort, myself and a bipartisan group of Illinois members, to educate the new administration and let them know the importance of the Ag Lab and what it means for the entire country and what it means for our agriculture community. And the last thing I would just tell you, is I remind people all the time, agriculture is the number one industry in the state of Illinois. It's not any industry in Chicago, it's agriculture. And that's a big part of what the Ag Lab does. And so we're hopeful that we can convince the administration of the importance of this Ag Lab. And I'm confident we'll be able to do that.
Right. When we talk about, so that's sort of the local impact. What do you think in terms of, this is the lab, obviously, where things like xanthan was created. Right now, I know the lab's working on biofuel, different research. What does that mean in terms of, I wonder if you can connect the dots for us for what that means for between research and the actual industry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we've done a good enough job in highlighting and promoting the work that goes on there. Many of these scientists and researchers really in a quiet way work every single day on behalf of really cutting edge technology and scientific breakthroughs. And for instance, with Zika, they're working on that right now and a number of other things. And that's part of what we're doing today is letting people know that important work that's going on. So we're going to continue to do that, over the course of the next several weeks. Talking to the Appropriations Committee and the administration.
Right. And when we think about this, the fact that this is a bipartisan effort, I just wanted to ask you about that in particular, because obviously when we're thinking about bipartisan efforts, we're thinking about, I just can't help but think of the awful events at the congressional baseball practice that happened a couple weeks ago with Steve Scalise, who I know is a roommate of a D.C. roommate of Representative Shimkus. I wonder if you think the fact that this is a bipartisan effort, if you could talk about that a little bit. How often do you think these bipartisan efforts happen? I have to say, for this past year, this is the first time I've seen sort of almost the entire Illinois congressional delegation come together on a bipartisan nature to say to the President Trump, this is something that that cannot happen.
Yeah, this is not about politics. This is about jobs. It's about the state of Illinois, and it's about members of Congress coming together to really, in a bipartisan way, talk about the importance of what the Ag Lab does for Illinois. And we've also tried to tell the administration if there's some consolidation that needs to be done, we think the Peoria Ag Lab is a good place to do that. As you mentioned earlier, 200 jobs there. We have room for expansion there. And we've really come together, both our two U.S. senators and Republican and Democrat members alike, and we're going to continue to do that.
Yeah. What case are you making to the administration? I mean, do you feel like this is something where this is hopefully an argument that you can win?
Yeah, we're confident that we can do that. We, had a lot of good meetings with the administration and with the relevant committees also.
Thanks so much, Representative. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
We're joined now by Representative Sherry Bustos, who represents the 17th Congressional District, which covers parts of Peoria, Rockford, and the Quad Cities. Representative, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, we were just talking to Representative LaHood about the economic impact of closing down these agricultural labs. I wanted to ask you what you think if this lab closure would mean, not just for Illinois, but for farmers and for agricultural in general.
It's a terrible move to even consider closing the nation's largest agricultural research lab. You know, our rural communities are facing tough times, and as is agriculture. And out of the lab that we are fortunate enough to have in Peoria, we have 85 PhDs who walk through those doors every day. We have another 100 or so biologists and botanists and scientists from various backgrounds who every day are researching what we can do with crops, different uses. They've come up with uses for bio lubricants in the manufacturing field. They're basically looking for new businesses in the rural areas, and it's a terrible idea to even consider something like this.
I wonder, when we look at funding for this and we think about shutting down funding for this across the system, what kind of long-term impact that would have when we look at the role that the U.S. government has played in research development versus private corporations across the years?
Well, something else that this ag research lab in Peoria is looking into is alternative uses for even nuisance crops. So there's something called pennycress that is this little teeny tiny seed that nobody's been able to figure anything that they can do with it. But the ag research lab has figured out that it has a high oil content. So even something like that, there could be a use for it. But this is a time when our rural communities are struggling. Donald Trump, when he was running for president in his 18-month or so campaign, talked about making America great again. And he did very, very well from an electoral perspective in the rural communities throughout the heartland, including in my congressional district. He won my congressional district. And yet, I would argue that he's now treating rural America and regions like ours as flyover country. In addition to having a plan to close the agricultural research lab, his budget also calls for a 21% cut in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And, we are in the process now of beginning to negotiate the 5-year farm bill, which expires next year. And we want to make sure that, for example, it has a robust crop insurance program. When we have our farmers who are at the mercy of Mother Nature, we want to make sure that they can stay viable and stay strong. So we have a big fight on our hands up ahead. I'm very pleased that we have bipartisan support to fight this proposal to close the Ag Research Lab in Peoria. And, I stand not only with Congressman LaHood in this fight, but every member of the Illinois congressional delegation, including our two senators, Duckworth and Durbin, are planning to fight with us.
And so I think, Congresswoman, I think what people might think is, what does it mean when you say you guys are going to fight for this, right? You sent a letter. A lot of you have signed it. I asked a Representative LaHood about this, and he just said, we're talking to people. We're confident that they're going to change their minds. What else do you do? You send a letter. How else do you try to change their minds when you're lobbying for something like this?
Well, in addition to just sending the letter, I also serve on the Ag Committee. So does Congressman Rodney Davis. So does Congressman Mike Boss. So we have three Illinoisans who sit on the Ag Committee, both Democrats and Republicans. So that's number one. Number two, the fact that the president knows that there's bipartisan support to keep this open, that's very important. And then number three, I had a personal conversation with the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, to talk to him about the importance of not just this ag research lab, but also about agricultural research in general. And so, what we can do is talk to the right people, work together, and that goes a long way in a place like Washington, D.C. There are so many partisan battles where there are these strict partisan lines. But in this case, we have Democrat and Republican support to talk about the importance of agricultural research. This is the Ag Lab, and you might have talked about this with Congressman LaHood, but where it was figured out how to do mass distribution of penicillin during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And, so we have amazing history out of this Ag Research Lab, but we also have amazing possibilities ahead. And it's hard to argue to close a place when you can show that for every $1 invested, we get a $10 return on that investment.
Representative Sherry Bustos, thank you for taking the time to join us. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
It's Congresswoman Sherry Bustos. We also caught up with her on yesterday afternoon. To find out more about what this closure means for Peoria's economy, we're joined now by Randon Geddes, the Startup Director of Greater Peoria Economic Development Council. Randon, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Glad to be here.
Yeah, Randon, I wonder if you can take us inside the lab, some of the things that might go on there, some of the research that's come out of there that people might not realize, especially if you're not in the Peoria area.
Sure. I can think of a couple of examples off the top of my head, and those would fall sort of under the category of research partnerships. Illinois Valley Plastics is a company that's a supplier to our manufacturing cluster, which is a fancy economic development term for the concentration of manufacturing businesses that we have here. They have an ongoing research partnership with the Ag Lab, so they outsource their research activities to some extent to the Ag Lab. Another example is ZooChem, is a company that's probably maybe about 10 years old, I think, that they make a product called xylitol, which is a synthetic sweetener that's actually good for your teeth. Can you believe that? So if you look at the back of the package of a sugar-free gum and it's got xylitol, there's a chance that that's coming out of the ag lab here in Peoria.
So what sounds like there's, are there, how much, it's, I know it's always hard to quantify economic impact, but how important would you say this ag lab is to Peoria's economy in terms of other businesses that are maybe rely on it just based on the fact that it's there and it's doing so much research?
Sure. I think Congresswoman Bustos did a pretty good job of highlighting that there are two conversations here. There's the present and there's the future. There's what is and there's what could be. At present, it's the jobs, like you just described, the jobs, the sort of ripple effect that a closure like this of this magnitude would have on our local economy here. There's the research partnerships, which I mentioned, and a culture of innovation, which, again, is a little bit hard to quantify. But over 200 jobs, our research-level jobs, represent $27 million in annual payroll. These are people who live, work, and play in Greater Peoria. They buy houses and cars here. Their kids go to public and private schools here. They buy groceries and go to restaurants here. So job loss, though, is just a part of the story. We have ongoing research partnerships that we talked about a little bit before, and those bring in entities, corporations, who partner with the Ag Lab to commercialize these innovations, all from both regionally and nationally. Congresswoman Bustos is off.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. What were you going to say about Congresswoman Bustos?
I think in an article that was published, she estimated there are around 70 ongoing research projects with private entities, and those efforts are intended to commercialize value-added products.
Yeah, so that's a good example of what you're saying, of sort of understanding the ripple effect of that. I wanted to ask you, in particular, when we think about Peoria recently with the news, the Caterpillar's moving its headquarters to Chicago. Would this potential closure be especially difficult to take coming so soon after that news as well?
Well, let me address the Caterpillar thing. It might not look good, but the fact is that Greater Peoria remains the hometown of Caterpillar. The company continues to employ 12,000 people here regionally, including the majority of their research and development operations and activities. So maybe it's a negative indicator, and the timing certainly doesn't work out in our favor. We'll miss those 300 jobs, but all is certainly not lost.
And I guess I just wonder about how people in Peoria are handling the potential closure of this, given that news as well. Are most folks in Peoria aware of this? What are they talking about?
They're talking just about the jobs, I think, mainly. And for us at the EDC, we've only existed in our current form for 3 years. So we're only now just exploring ways that we can form partnership with the Ag Lab to spur more commercialization of the technologies that could lead to economic growth for our region specifically. We have to replace the jobs that are leaving, being outsourced, going to Chicago, this and that. So we're working on programs with the Ag Lab. We're very good at producing and moving things all around the country and the world by air, land, river, and rail. That's why whiskey distilling was so huge 100 years ago here. But companies from outside the region assign, we will work a project manager from out with.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's, Randon, it sounds like there's lots of ways you guys are trying to work on not just the tying together. It sounds unfortunate in a way, because it sounds like there's ways that you are right now trying to work to tie in the economy further to the Ag Lab. I just wonder, because we just heard from two congressional representatives from the area saying they feel very confident that they can save the lab from being closed down. Do you feel as confident as they do?
I do, and I think for a couple of reasons. I think if we're able to tell a pretty good story about how we're able to turn some of those technologies into commercial products, that we'll be able to tell a solid economic development story.
Yeah, unfortunately, Randon, we're out of time, but thanks for joining us. That's Randon Geddes. He's the Startup Peoria coordinator with the Greater Peoria Economic Development Council, talking about the Ag Lab. Randon, thanks for being with us. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As Illinois lawmakers approach a Friday deadline to come up with a budget, the state's road construction projects hang in the balance along with all the other stuff. Yesterday, Illinois Secretary of Transportation said there's 900 construction projects ongoing across the state that could possibly be halted by the weekend. One of the major projects right now is the construction of the I-74 bridge in the Quad Cities. It's a joint project between Iowa and Illinois. Joining us on the line now is Lacey Scarmana. She's a reporter with WVIK in the Quad Cities and was at the ribbon-cutting ceremony yesterday for the bridge project. Lacey, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So yesterday, the governor came all the way up to your part of Illinois for this bridge opening. He said he was sneaking away because it was so important to him. What was the mood like yesterday?
Yeah, it was a celebration for sure. This project has been in the works for a really long time, about 2 decades. In Iowa, that means it's gone through 4 Department of Transportation directors. In Illinois, that's 6 transportation secretaries. They've been working for several years to get this going. Governor Rauner came and shared his personal experience of growing up in northern Illinois and relying on the bridge a lot, and now as an avid motorcycle rider traveling across the Midwest.
So how is the funding going to work for this? Because what has Iowa said it will do in terms of funding for this bridge, given the fiscal situation we're in here in Illinois?
Yeah, so it's a joint project. Iowa is paying the main cost of the bridge, and then Illinois will reimburse them. Eventually, it'll be a 50-50 effort. The transportation secretary says there aren't any bills due for a while on this. And yesterday, the mood was pretty confident from everyone I spoke to that there would be a budget in place and Illinois would be able to start making payments on this. But this project will not be affected at the end of the week if there is not a budget in place.
This project in particular, because Iowa's going to foot the bill for it. Did they say how long they're willing to keep paying the bill and waiting for Illinois to pay them back?
They didn't. Again, when asked, they would just say, you know, we're confident it's going to work out. We're happy to help. It's a joint project. They really want to see this through. So they said that the construction of this bridge will not be delayed by Illinois' financial problems.
As we mentioned, Governor Rauner was at that ceremony, along with the Illinois Secretary of Transportation, Randall Blankenhorn. Here's what our Secretary of Transportation, Blankenhorn, had to say.
We've got to get this budget passed, not just for this project, but for all the projects in Illinois. Come Friday, if we don't have a budget, we have no choice but to shut down construction. And luckily, this bridge is Iowa-led, so it can keep working. But we have 900 projects around the state that need to keep moving and need to keep acting, and we've got to get the General Assembly back to Springfield to do their job.
That tape from Lacey Scarmana, who's on the line with us with from WVIK, where she's a reporter. She covered this event yesterday. Lacey, Governor Rauner had prepared remarks. Did he take any questions from the press? Did he talk about the budget crisis or the special session?
He did not. As you mentioned, he made a quick reference to skipping out on some of the negotiations happening in Springfield yesterday, talking about how important it was for him to be there at this groundbreaking ceremony for the bridge. He made a quick joke about that and then didn't mention it again. Did not take questions from the press afterwards. I, you know, tried to follow him out and he just walked to the car and was heading back to Springfield, his press secretary said.
That's Lacey Scarmana from WVIK in the Quad Cities telling us about where the governor was yesterday, this I-74 bridge project that is going ahead regardless of what happens on Friday because Iowa is paying the bill. Hey, Lacey, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The secretary, Blankenhorn, did mention some 900 projects that he's worried about, and I want to bring in a few more people into the conversation now to talk about that. Don Rosenbarger is the business development manager with Delta Companies. They do asphalt work for the state in southern Illinois. Also on the line with me is John Bryan. He's president of Geneva Construction Company in Aurora, about 40 miles west of Chicago. He's also on the board of directors with the Illinois Road and Transportation Builders Association. Don, John, thank you for joining me on the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks for having us.
Don, let's start with you. I know you were in Southern Illinois today. You were meeting with crews ahead of this Friday's deadline. What are you telling the folks who are out there working on the roads?
Well, Nyla, we really had two issues that we were meeting with our folks this week. First is safety, because that is a value to our company. So we wanted to meet with all of our employees to encourage them to be safe in their work environment, but also to remind them that come this Friday, their paychecks are going to come to an end. The projects are going to be shut down. We've already received letters from the Illinois Department of Transportation instructing us to cease operations at the close of business on Friday. We have notified our employees a couple weeks ago through emails and also letters that we sent to their homes explaining the situation and encouraging them to contact their state representatives and state senators to get a budget passed.
Don, how many workers are we talking about for you?
We have about 90 people on our payroll here in Southern Illinois. And for them, we're seasonal. They can start work typically in May, and they're probably finished by the end of October. So that's really only a six-month window for them to earn their entire year's wages. If this budget impasse lasts a month, that's 1 month out of six. That's 16% of their wages. So they're going to take a 16% cut in wages this year.
Hmm. John, what about you? How many contracts do you have with the state right now?
Well, the economy is a little different for me. I'm a smaller contractor. I have about 120 employees. And right now I have five contracts directly with IDOT. And of those five, one has been suspended before I started. And the other four are currently about 80% completed. And we had to stop well over a week ago on those contracts because there's a certain type of asphalt called a level binder that you can't let traffic run over, and there's no way we would have got it covered and completed at the stage of construction we were in. So that's a total of five jobs. Now, there are some jobs that are going to continue, and these are jobs that are bid through the local agencies. They receive motor fuel tax from the state, but it's all front-loaded by these municipalities and or counties. So some of those jobs I fortunately will be able to work on. But on the flip side, like Don, there are numerous jobs in and around Chicago. I mean, the Circle Interchange, the Burn Interchange, the flyover at Lakeshore Drive and I-55 are two very high-profile projects that will shut down completely, not to mention pretty much any bridge job. And if you want to talk about safety, that's one of the most unsafe areas. The lanes are narrowed. There's different lane configurations that the traveling public are not used to, and they will be shut down completely because all those have state money. They're all let through IDOT. So it's a weird dichotomy. No one exactly knows what exactly is going to happen except for IDOT, and know that those jobs are going to be shut down because we have had notices, and slowly but surely, my jobs will slowly shut down, just like Don. Don makes a great point. These are seasonal workers, and it's not fair to the motoring public. They voted last year on a safe roads amendment to put our money in a lockbox. Overwhelmingly, 80-20. All we need from Illinois, and I'm not going to get into the politics of who's right and who's wrong. All I know is that the people of the state have said, hey, we want our roads fixed. We want our bridges to be safe. All we need is an appropriation to continue to work to do what the taxpayers and the motoring public have requested.
Right. So to be clear, that amendment, because I know people are earlier this morning, we were talking about that, questions about the Safe Roads Amendment, which did pass. You do need a budget in place because you need the actual appropriation before you can have access to that money. That's what you're saying, right, John?
Correct. And like I said, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, but we need that appropriation. Tollway work in the nine-county area of greater Chicagoland, that will continue as long as the comptroller's office, either wants to or continue to write checks or itself shuts down.
Okay.
And you're talking upwards of anywhere 20,000 jobs that eventually may be impacted. If you look at research, if the state of Illinois' budget is $2.2 billion, that's just IDOT's budget, and you say half of it's going on right now, that's $1 billion. That equates into anywhere from 20 to 29,000 jobs, depending if you listen to the University of Massachusetts, Duke, or the Federal Highway Administration. That's a lot of people that's going to be thrown out of work. And like Don said, they're all seasonal, and they're going to, you know, just that 1 week of losing pay is enormous. And it's not like we can tell Mother Nature to hold off on winter. We have a definite time frame where we have to stop.
Yeah, everyone knows that summer is construction season here in Illinois. Don, let me ask you a question. John, both of you have appropriately started with your workers and the huge personal costs to them. Don, how much does it cost you to pause? Like, how much does it cost your company to pause projects? Because I imagine there's a business cost for you involved as well.
There certainly is. We have people that are salary that will be here regardless of whether we're working or not, and we'll continue to pay those folks. So we will have to absorb that cost ourselves. But there's also the cost of the shutdown of the project and the remobilization of the project. It certainly will be our intent to seek compensation for those additional costs, which is additional cost to the taxpayer because of this shutdown.
Right. So you have probably, I wonder, is there an ability? I know, for example, when the state doesn't pay, like, for example, healthcare providers, they have to pay back at a 10% interest rate. Do you all have a similar, and Don, I don't know if you want to weigh in here, if you know, is there a similar way for Don or John, either of you, to weigh in on, is there a way for you to seek additional money from the state for how much this is costing you?
Well, the biggest thing is going to be the traffic control. Well, I mean, the biggest thing that's just going to sit out there is traffic control. And so the state is going to have to make additional appropriations or additional payments to the contractors to make sure that the job sites are safe, regardless, you know, if we have to do it and then we bill the state later. So, but Don said a lot of these jobs, the mobilization, remobilization, it can cost each individual company, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, which eventually will be paid for by IDOT. I mean, there's an estimate that just the shutdown itself will cost the state $20 million, and it's estimated an additional $14 million each week will be spent to keep the 900 active jobs safe. And as those jobs and as more and more jobs are impacted, then you're going to see those escalations just explode.
Yeah, so John, what would this look like if Friday, say there's no budget come Friday? Is everyone just going to be driving by empty construction sites? So I imagine all the cones will be set up, the lanes will be blocked off as if the construction is going to happen, but then it won't be there?
Pretty much, yes. On any state road, on any state-funded project directly with IDOT, I would say 99% of your bridge projects will all just have road construction ahead signs, speed limit signs, barrels, barricades, and no personnel.
Don, your company does road work in Missouri and Arkansas in addition to Illinois. I wonder what the thoughts are with Delta companies about doing business in Illinois. Does this make you guys reexamine the fact that you're doing business here?
Well, we're committed to Illinois, but it does make us pause when it comes time to invest. We have quarries, we have asphalt plants, and certainly we have construction equipment. If you look at our quarry, any piece there, one of the haul trucks could cost $750,000. An asphalt paver out on the road might cost $500,000. Do we make those investments in our future in Illinois? We also have the hiring and training of people there. How much of an investment do we make in that going forward due to the uncertainty of funding in Illinois? It is frustrating for sure.
John, what about you? I mean, you're based in Aurora. You're not going anywhere, but I wonder what about you in terms of, how do you feel? Do you just feel
stuck.
Like you're stuck here?
I am stuck here, but Don made a great point. You know, an asphalt paver is $400,000. 80% of my equipment is Caterpillar equipment that I buy through a local dealer in Elmhurst. And of all my equipment, except for some specialty rollers that are manufactured in Germany, it's anywhere up upwards $5 million a year. That equipment is all not only distributed, but manufactured within a 500-mile radius of Aurora, Illinois. If that isn't a direct impact on our economy, I don't know what is. I mean, we are an economic engine. You know, you can say that it generates, a $2.2 billion is appropriated to the highways. So if you use an economic factor of four, that's $8 billion that's being generated into the economy.
You gentlemen, both of you. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I appreciate you taking the time for us. John Bryan with Geneva Construction in Aurora. Don Rosenbarger, a business development manager with Delta Companies down in Southern Illinois. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for tuning in today.